When we talk about placebo, we're usually talking about some kind of inert intervention, something like a sugar pill that we might give in place of real treatment. But what happens when the sugar pill helps? What happens when the expectation of benefit, more than the substance of the treatment itself, is what actually seems to drive the change process? Well, you don't need a PhD to understand that one of the most powerful things we can do for somebody who's suffering is to help them find hope. Hope that their situation, their circumstances, their pain can change. Hope that they themselves might change. An expectation of benefit is crucial for a patient of any kind, otherwise why keep coming back? Yet these effects are largely controlled for or dismissed in the research. The goal is usually to show how a treatment works over and above this kind of expectation or placebo. In everyday conversation, we often hear, oh, that's just placebo, as if to say, that's not real, whatever that means. Well, today's guest, John Kelly, has quite a different perspective on this topic. John's one of the world's leading experts in this area, having spent a whole career studying the therapeutic significance of placebo and expectation effects. In this episode, Bruce sits down with John to explore the role of placebo and expectation in psychotherapy and how discounting these effects does a great disservice to patients and to science. Dr. John Kelly is the Deputy Director of the Program in Placebo Studies and Therapeutic Encounters, which is hosted at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's professor of psychology at Endicott College and a licensed clinical psychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. John also has his own private practice in the greater Boston area, for any of you that might be nearby. Your host, Dr. Bruce Wampold, is one of the world's leading experts in psychotherapy and has published over 400 academic articles on this topic and numerous books, including the hugely influential The Great Psychotherapy Debate, The Evidence for What Makes Psychotherapy Work, and the latest edition of Persuasion and Healing. Today's podcast is brought to you by CarePaths EHR, a practice management and electronic health record system with integrated measurement-based care, telehealth, and HIPAA-compatible AI-assisted progress notes. Research shows that therapists can get better outcomes today through measurement-based care, and with CarePaths, that's never been easier. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about how we can help you to make your therapy better. Well, the rain is here, so that's my cue. As the kids say these days, please smash those like and subscribe buttons. Share this with all your friends and colleagues, and please do stay tuned. We have a lot of exciting new content in store for you just over the horizon. And with that, let's stay tuned for this fascinating conversation between Bruce Wampold and John Kelly.
Well, hello, John. It's great to see you. It's been a few years since we've seen each other in person, so we'll do it this way. I'm really eager to talk to you about a number of different issues. You know, you have various roles, as we talked about in the introduction. You're a professor of psychology at Endicott College. You're deputy director of the program in placebo studies and the therapeutic encounter at Harvard Medical School, and you're a clinical psychologist with a private practice. So that's an interesting array of roles. And today I really want to get into how you integrate your knowledge of these various areas, particularly how you structure your work with patients, given your knowledge about placebos. So let's get started with placebos, placebo effects, and placebo mechanisms. You know, the idea of placebos is common. People know what they are, but precise definitions are really important. So would you talk for a few minutes about what's the definition of a placebo? What actually is it? And what's a placebo effect? And then we'll spend some time talking about the mechanisms. So,
okay,
take it away.
It's, Thanks, Bruce. Thanks very much for inviting me. It's great to see you. We haven't seen each other in a few years, and it's very nice to see you, at least virtually. I think you're right about placebo, that most people are pretty aware of what a placebo might be. And certainly the most common way of thinking about it is an inert pill, like a sugar pill. People say usually it's not sugar, but something like cellulose, microcrystalline cellulose, that's meant to be inert. So I think that's reasonably straightforward, although you could then ask about other things, you know, like placebo devices, so a medical device that could be not intended to actually do anything. So maybe it's some kind of like transmagnetic stimulation of the brain. You could have some sort of device that showed lights going on and maybe some sound and this sort of thing to indicate that something might be happening when in fact it's not actually emanating anything from the device. And you can go beyond with that. But I think that's reasonably straightforward. I think the problems for me anyway arise around placebo effect. That I feel and have usually say whenever I talk about it, that it's kind of an oxymoron, because we just said, well, we have this placebo that is inert. Let's just stick with the pill for the moment. How can we say that something that is inert and has no effect has an effect? A placebo effect is the effect of something that has no effect.
Yeah.
We have this very strange, problem with that. And I think, it's unfortunate that it's named that, but I think we're really stuck. There's been a lot of talk of I'm sure we'll get to different names you could call this, like the context effect, the context of treatment, but nothing has really taken off to the degree that it's replaced it. So I think to some degree we're stuck with the term, but it does kind of point us towards something that's not really where the action is. It's not the contents of the pill. You could say it might be the pill, the action of the ritual of taking the pill. So I think that it's kind of, that's really, I think, what it is. It's everything else in the therapeutic relationship and the context and the actions that the patient might take outside of the therapy. All of that is what drives, I think, this placebo effect. But it's not the placebo, it's just not the placebo.
Right. We think of treatment effects as due to the essence of the treatment, the ingredient. Right. Here we're saying there really are no active ingredients, but we have an effect nevertheless.
Yeah, it's interesting, you say that, because I think that that's the whole idea of a randomized controlled trial, where you have the real drug and everything else, and you're contrasting it against the placebo, which has no direct, physiological effect, no pharmacological effect, and everything else. And we're doing this subtraction to identify that there's a effect, a specific effect of the drug above and beyond everything else. And I think placebo research is really about moving one level down to say, okay, well, what's going on with all this change that might be improvement that might be happening in response to essentially what you could call no treatment.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you're talking about randomized placebo-controlled trials in medicine, which is the standard for approval of drugs, as you know. So a drug has to be superior to the effects of this inert ingredient. So, historically, as we know, the placebo effect has been kind of denigrated, right? It's just a placebo effect.
Yeah.
So that kind of leads us into, is there a placebo effect? And as we know through the history of placebo research, there are those that claim, oh yeah, very definitely there's a placebo effect, and others in large meta-analysis that received lots of publicity, saying that the placebo effect is rather small or non-existent. So you're heavily involved in placebo research and the society, SIPS, the Society for the, you say it, Jack.
Yeah, sorry. It's Society for Interdisciplinary Placebo studies, right? Exactly.
Yeah. And one of the founders of the organization. Yeah. So, where are we with that? Do placebos work? Do they work for pain, which subjective judgment of something? Well, just yeah. give us a broad overview of where we are with that.
Right. To go back to the meta-analysis itself, I think the claim that was made, I think, in that meta-analysis was that that we need to sort of compare placebo, whatever placebo response that might appear to occur, against what would happen if you didn't do anything at all. So I think part of the placebo response, that is apparent, might just be the passage of time, that over time, at the beginning, if someone comes into a trial and they're already kind of sick, they're likely just, even if you did nothing, drug-wise or whatever the placebo effect is, which we'll get to, they still might have gotten better over time just because of the natural sort of history. And a number of other kinds of effects like that. And I think that was the claim from the meta-analysis, which I think was very important. They were saying, well, it's not like people don't get better in these placebo conditions, but much of it might just be what would have happened even if he didn't do anything. And we have to distinguish those from each other. And there was what the I think a very good thing about that meta-analysis is it forced people interested in placebo effects to refine their measures and take that criticism seriously, and it I think generated a lot of research in response. One paper, particularly, we may talk about later, that involved the irritable bowel syndrome, and I can describe that at some point if you'd like. But I think we do know, especially for pain, you mentioned pain, and especially conditions that are subjectively reported, patient reported kind of outcomes. That we tend to get pretty robust effects that with, you know, good research. Now, that doesn't mean that there's placebo effect for everything. I don't think that's true. And I think, how would you suspect that something might be amenable? My kind of thinking about it is that things that are that have a psychological dimension where you can, so for example, GI disorders clearly have physiological components to them, and you know, it could be all kinds of reasons that are happening. But I think we all know that our psychological state of mind can also influence our gastrointestinal system, you know, through anxiety and worries and this sort of thing. And something like that, you can imagine, would be amenable. Same would be true of maybe headaches or lots of things. Pain, we all know, pain is a great example, and I think it's the best studied, that pain is this very same pain stimulus. It depends on the context, the situation, how much you experience it. All of us feel how it is to be trying to sleep with a pain that may not even be that bad during the day when we're just distracted and engaged, and then we're trying to sleep and there's nothing else to focus on. That very same pain can be pretty much more distressful for a person. So I think those kinds of things, that are amenable or conceivably amenable to psychological, because I think that's fun, you know, and maybe this is my bias, but as a psychologist, I think that the mechanism in the end, I think there are a lot of components to it, but in the end goes through the patient's, somehow through the patient's psychology to produce a change or an outcome.
But John, you know, from my reading of the placebo literature, and my own understanding of how this works, I agree with you. But then we get an effect for placebos with Parkinson's disease, right? L-DOPA placebo. Patients are told this is the active medication, and it has a relatively robust effect.
Yeah, I think that's I see what you mean, and I agree with you. And then there's some other examples like that, I think. I think it has to do with our tendency to still all of us be dualists, you know, that there's a mind that's separate from the body. As a sort of slightly not placebo oriented necessarily, but I still remember when there were first neuroimaging studies to show that after psychotherapy, patients' brains had actually changed That would made a big splash, you know, and to me, it is was completely unsurprising. Now, where those changes might take place, that's interesting, of course. But the fact that a person who's profoundly depressed and later improves through psychotherapy, that there's some change in their functioning of their brain in terms of neurochemicals and whatever, you know, is, I think, unsurprising if that should be the case. The Parkinson's one is, I'm not an expert in that area, so it's very provocative because it feels like something that there's just no way that this could, but I think there has to be, right? Because we know that the placebo cannot have an effect directly, it's inert. And the only other way is through some kind of psychological mechanism that then causes a real change in the functioning and helping people with Parkinson's to some degree.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the part about this dualist kind of distinction, so much in so many different areas of physiology and psychology, we see that mind-body connection. We have all this research on the gut and the brain. So our ideas about what is psychological and what is physiological or brain-based, I think, is something that we have to think about in terms of placebo, but we're going to be talking about psychotherapy later on. You know, your example of the change in the brain, when I go outside on a sunny day and it's glorious, I do have a change in my brain. I mean, is just, you know, we have a lot of research about the effects of being in nature and its effect on both the brain and our subjective well-being. Mm. I think the other finding, which is important, is the idea of placebos for pain, that it's not just a subjective report, but there's a release of endogenous opioids in the mm-hmm. brain. So in a sense, we, in a way, are medicating ourselves from the ingestion of the placebo or the procedure. So it's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah.
Those studies are amazing. And I think especially interesting that one of the ways that they know that endogenous opioids are activated is that they can simultaneously give the person with the placebo something to block, naltrexone or something along those lines to block the opioids and find that it does actually abolish to a great degree the placebo effect, suggesting that, there really is a physiological, in this case, substrate, you'd say, to the effect, that it's not. Yeah. That's what gets back to, you know, it's all in your head, you know, kind of thing, right? That's a kind of denigration. But in a way, it is in your head in the sense that you were saying that in our minds are connected to our bodies, and what we think and feel and experience that have real effects on the rest of our body. But I say, of course, you know, even though my phenomenological experience is, it feels like there's a me that's separate. That's very, very powerful for all of us, separate from the body in some way. But it's apparently not true. That feeling that seems so strong is not the case, it seems like.
Yeah. So, you know, I encourage all my students, psychotherapy students, to read the placebo research. So I think it just opens up or emphasizes the idea that we make changes, we experience things in so many fascinating ways that, and we'll get into this, we talk about psychotherapy, but what we do in psychotherapy is often, I think, not exactly what we think we're doing. Right? There's a mm-hmm. process. These patients are getting better. And I think, well, that was a beautiful intervention. But that wasn't it at all.
Yeah. So do you know, just as while we're on that topic, just briefly, do you know Irving Yalom has a number of interesting books, but one of them is called something like Every Day Gets a Little Closer, I think, something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a really interesting book that he and a patient who was having trouble with writing, had a writing block, would see each other for periods of time, about 4 months, at the end of which each of them wrote about what they were, what was happening in the therapy that they did not show to each other. And they did this for a long period of time. And it was, you know, part of the therapy for this person was, you know, writing again, but was really interesting. And then the book was about both of them, you know, their observations of what was happening. And what's amazing is exactly what you're saying, that frequently Yalom would think in his notes for this 4 month section of all these wonderful interpretations, et cetera, and the patient would report something seemingly not important, you know, was not on the radar screen at all as being particularly important to her. So very interesting, you know, and it could be that they're both right, right? There are things that have happened that, even though the person doesn't perceive it as being particularly important, it's planted some seeds to allow something else to occur, you know, but still quite interesting. Right.
That's an important point. There are different perceptions of what went on, and they're both probably right, and they're both probably wrong in some ways. I mean, we have these perspectives, but there's things that are happening out of awareness. Both the therapist and the patient are not reporting exactly. We know enough about witness, eyewitness testimony, and so forth, that those perceptions are biased in a way, given our understanding of the situation, the social interaction, and the world. Mm. Yeah, fascinating. So, John, how do placebos work? How is it that we're experiencing pain, let's say, acute pain, post-operative pain, we're given a placebo analgesic, we're told it's a painkiller, we experience less pain, and we have this phenomenon that it releases endogenous opioids in our brain. How does this work? What's the mechanism?
Well, it depends on the level of analysis. In a way, many of the people who are more interested in physiology would say, you've already said it for the case of pain, you've said what the mechanism is, which is this release of endogenous opioids. But how does that happen? You know, which is the part that I'm kind of interested in. And usual explanations are, which I think are pretty good, is that it has something to do with expectations that the patient. Like in the case of pain, that classic study, in one condition, they're getting the painkiller. They know that they're getting it. They're even maybe told this is going to make you feel better soon. And the other condition, it's given to them by a computer, and they don't know exactly when it's happening, when they will get it. So they don't have particularly, they know they're going to get it sometime, but they don't have a sort of an acute expectation. And the idea is that expectancy somehow, now that the exact, I don't know if we worked that out, but that expectancy drives this release of the endogenous opiates that then provide the person with relief. Another might be, classical conditioning, where if it's something the patient's doing, or even getting the injections repeatedly, there's a way in which that sort of procedure, I guess you'd call it, can produce placebo effects, not just in people too. It can happen with animals as well. If you inject animals repeatedly with the painkiller and then inject them with saline, they also show the same kind of an effect. So it doesn't require a conversation necessarily. And the other area, the area of particular interest, other mechanism, I think, of particular interest to psychotherapists is the therapeutic relationship. Because I think if you have a not very good relationship with whoever is treating you, and you don't have a lot of confidence in their judgment, or you think that maybe they know what they're doing, but you don't feel like they have your best interest at heart somehow, you know, that they don't really like you, or they think you complain too much about pain or whatever, I think that is also going to affect how, you know, your expectancies, and, you know, eventually how much pain relief, if we're talking about pain or whatever it is, it's going to reduce whatever the benefit is that you would ordinarily get.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. We'll get to this idea about the relationship in just a minute, but the conditioning versus expectations is an interesting one, because there are those, the group that say conditioning is really the inducement of expectations. It doesn't have to be conscious expectation, for instance, in canines, but there is an expectation that this action is going to have this result.
I'm in complete sympathy with that viewpoint. I do think that that's why I think I inserted it in my thinking about classical conditioning is that it is a mechanism, I think, for inducing, and a very effective mechanism for inducing expectancy changes. But there has been for a while a bit of a, you know, people think one is more important, you know, this kind of thing. And those are hard things to finally adjudicate. But I do think it doesn't really make sense to me at all that conditioning could work if there weren't some kind of, you know, we can call it different things. That's to be, like you said, it doesn't have to be conscious. And by the way, not even conscious on, you know, you mentioned an animal could, you know, could have a different levels of consciousness. It can't verbalize, you know, but there's something there that the animals clearly have expectancies of various sorts, you know, and they can't say what they are, but verbally, but they have them. And I think I think that's how conditioning works, in my view.
Mm-hmm. I know when I listen to people who psychologists who study conditioning, the discussion gets very technical and quite complex.
Are you in therapy and not sure if it's working? The Making Therapy Better app lets you easily measure how you're doing over time. Mental health research shows that tracking your progress and discussing it with your therapist leads to better results. So download the Making Therapy Better app today. It's absolutely free and takes less than 5 minutes per week. Results are easily shared with your therapist so you can both be sure that you're on the right track. It's time to make your therapy better.
Let's turn to this idea of relationship, and I want to have you describe the study you did with Ted Kapchuk on irritable bowel syndrome, because I always had this idea that the relationship was part of this placebo effect, but also clearly part of the effects in psychotherapy. But, you know, in psychotherapy, we can't manipulate the relationship. We can't tell the therapist not to be empathic and caring for ethical reasons and pragmatic reasons as well. But the placebo model is so great for testing this. So when I read the study that Ted and you did, I was going, this is it. So describe that study.
Sure.
Let's take a little time to discover.
Yeah, it's a really it's certainly in the top couple of studies that I've been involved with. And I just want to acknowledge that there are Ted Kapchuk, very important in the study, but lots of people, Irving Kirsch and Tony Lembo was the GI expert on it. And lots of people, these studies take, you know, huge numbers of people. And so I played some role in it, but anyway, the basic idea is that this study did arise from that meta-analysis that you referenced, which was the beginning of the 2000s when those meta-analyses came out. And it took a while to get this study finished, but it was published in 2008, so, and took years. These things take a long time. But the basic idea is we wanted to take up this challenge, and we decided to work in gastrointestinal GI, and we used irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, because we thought that there would be likely, you know, you want to start with something where you think you have a good chance, and most people think that the psychology matters. And we used acupuncture, and what we did was it very complicated in the sense that we did what's sometimes called a placebo run-in. So there's a kind of placebo acupuncture that involves, which seems hard to believe, but you can kind of have a needle that looks like a real acupuncture needle that appears to puncture the skin, and then patient sees that and feels the pressure, you know, of the needle, but actually doesn't go in. The needle itself goes back up into the housing, the handle, and so it doesn't penetrate the skin. So that's one way it's not really acupuncture. Second way is we don't put them on the correct acupuncture points for GI disorders. And the third way that helps maintain this illusion is that the patients have never had acupuncture before. All patients eventually, if they want, get real acupuncture. So part of this, you know, that's part of the enticement. This is a sort of a novel way of approaching it. So that's how people came into the study. So we had, that was a sort of the treatment that was going to be done. And we had three conditions, three groups. So if you recall, of course, the meta-analyses focused on the idea, well, what would happen if you didn't do anything with people? So we had a group called the waiting list group where they met with the doctors and they filled out the forms and everything, but they didn't get any treatment. And they knew eventually, if they so chose, they would get treatment at the end of the study. The other two groups both got acupuncture. And it was what's called a placebo run-in, which is done fairly commonly in drug trials, because everyone gets a placebo. And they're deceived in some ways. Eventually, they're debriefed at the end, but they don't know that there's no chance of getting an actual real acupuncture at the beginning. They know eventually they will likely get one, but beginning they're not. So everyone's getting placebo acupuncture. And of those other two groups, one group gets placebo acupuncture from a very neutral, sort of business-like acupuncturist. And in the other condition, the acupuncturists do what they normally do, which is be much more engaging, warm, empathic, some touching of the patient, you know, discussion of the meaning of their symptoms. A lot of different, we had a kind of not a formal script, but sort of a kind of outline of things we wanted them to do to try to foster.
And you called it the name you used, the prototypic healing relationship.
In the study, the original study, we called it augmented. But in some more work that we did, we perceived it as being, we're trying to create something that would be similar to other medical interactions, but still consistent, of course, with acupuncture, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an augmented treatment that's warm, empathic, friendly, and a limited treatment, kind of business-like, not negative, just sort of neutral. They said even something like, you know, this is a scientific study. We just want to kind of focus on the acupuncture. We're not going to have a lot of dialogue, you know, and so fairly neutral, they would answer questions, of course, but it wasn't an in-depth kind of interview.
Yeah.
And that's basically,
but presumably the patients in that group felt this was an expert acupuncturist.
Yes.
So the expectations that they're getting acupuncture and that acupuncture would be relieve their symptoms and distress.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that would be an implicit kind of, because they weren't in the relationship, in this limited relationship, the acupuncturists didn't make any efforts to increase directly expectancies. Mm-hmm. But of course, the expectancies are there because coming into the trial, that's the whole idea, new treatment, you know, acupuncture, something they'd never tried before. So I agree with you. I think there's expectancies for sure. By the way, we picked acupuncture also because it's dramatic and there's some evidence that more impressive treatments tend to have bigger placebo effects. So it was another reason for choosing that rather than a pill. And you can see where we're going with this. We were hoping that these would show a nice separation, which they did indeed show on multiple output measures. Everybody got better, even people on average. I should say everyone, not all patients, but the groups on average. The waitlist treatment group showed some improvement, again, because over time people tend to get better. And I want to also say, because I think it's important, that the waitlist group didn't really just get nothing. They met with a doctor. They knew they were going to get acupuncture eventually. So they did have some expectancy, maybe not right now, but that might have felt comforting to them.
Mm-hmm.
The research assistants tend to be very friendly and helpful. So in a way, they got something. But so maybe there could be another group where they didn't even know they're being followed. That's almost impossible to do. But anyway, and then the acupuncture it by itself, you know, without a lot of interaction, produced a significantly better outcome. And then the best outcome was having the interaction, you know, the augmented warm empathic interaction. And I think we think of this as kind of like a dismantling study, like in psychotherapy studies, dismantling the components of the placebo effect. Just being in a study or just the passage of time is the wait list. The limited acupuncture is mostly just and the addition of the placebo acupuncture. And then the third group, the augmented, is the addition on top of all of that of the therapeutic relationship.
Yeah, that I mean, it's a nice experimental establishment that the warm, caring, empathic interaction adds to the effect.
Exactly.
I mean, there are people in psychotherapy who say, "Well, that's good, but you've never shown that experimentally," and I like to show them this study, John, because this is an experimental study of the effects of the relationship over and above this expectation that this intervention will be helpful. And as you know now, there's several more studies. Leah Crum at Stanford has done some brilliant work in this area. Yeah, yeah. So fascinating. And, you know, I'm taken by the name of your center at the Harvard Medical School, because it's not just program and placebo studies, it's program and placebo studies and the therapeutic encounter. So
yes,
you've made it legitimate in kind of the placebo area as well as medicine to say that encounter is important.
Yeah, I think that is, and it's outside of psychotherapy per se, but I think it is incredibly important in medicine. I think medical schools, you know, emphasize to some degree the relationship, but I think it's kind of a little, sometimes, you know, a little bit lip service to some degree. Because, and frankly, you know, there's a lot for people to learn in medical school and in the rest of their training, the fellowships. There's so many important technical aspects, but I think losing sight of the fact that these other components, the relationship itself, can be healing, is important and can have a, you know, I think, you know, showing that with actual randomized controlled trial, I think is really important. So that, because otherwise people would just say, well, you know, it sounds like that's true. And they'll say, okay, but they don't, you know, couldn't be that important. You know, it would be kind of the viewpoint. And I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, it made a big difference in how people responded. There was a, you know, each step up was a jump. So the expectancies involved with the acupuncture, a substantial more improvement, and then again another jump on top of that with the relationship.
Yeah, yeah. And in a follow-up study, John, you looked at differences among the acupuncturists and found that some acupuncturists had better outcomes in each of the conditions. So even though you instructed them in this kind of augmented or prototypic health interaction, there was something that some of the acupuncturists were doing that made them more effective than others, which is mirrors the findings in psychotherapy that the therapist makes the difference.
It does, and I do want to say though to always criticize my own work. That finding I think is less strong in this not in the sense of effect size, but in the sense of less we're not as sure about it because it wasn't an a priori. You know, we didn't experimentally manipulate that. It's, you know, those kinds of things, and yet it is consistent, as you say, with other studies, But, you know, the other thing is we tried pretty hard to figure out what is it about those particular acupuncturists. Now, there weren't a lot of, so that's a problem in terms of statistically, you know. And we were unsuccessful at really figuring out what it was that made those individuals appear to have better outcomes across both versus other people who didn't have such good outcomes. There's something there, but whatever the special sauce is, the secret sauce, we did not. It's a hard thing to find out, I guess.
Fascinating. So did you, and I forget this, did you actually look at videotapes of the interaction?
We did. So we did a secondary study. So again, not an experimental manipulation. So again, I think I'd always want to put that caveat on it. But very interesting in that we used a measure of the interaction called the psychotherapy Q sort, which is used for psychotherapy, but because we had the sense that the interactions that are happening here have some degree or might be similar to psychotherapy, and we basically found that the interaction that people were having, the Q sort has a couple of prototypes. Like one of them is a CBT prototype, and one is a sort of more psychodynamic psychotherapy prototype. And what we found is that the people who were in the augmented, warm, empathic, friendly condition, sort of their interaction when it was Q sorted, we watched the entire videotape, did the Q sort on them with multiple raters, that they conformed to something which is your work really is the common factors. They weren't doing something like psychodynamic psychotherapy, not that surprising, but they weren't doing that. But they weren't really doing, you know, CBT either, really. They were doing sort of what's common across those things. So if you more or less average them, that's not exactly it, but average them, you get kind of what's not distinct about each, but kind of what's the common factors, and which is what we were going for when you think about it, empathy mm-hmm. and relationship. Mm-hmm. We also did, which I think was quite interesting, we asked people who were not psychotherapists, people who were medical doctors principally, who were considered expert clinicians in terms of the relationship, and we asked them to create a prototype with the Q sort, the psychotherapy Q sort, of what they considered an ideal medical interaction. And what was fascinating is that ideal medical interaction that they created, prototype, was very similar, very highly correlated, like 0.8 or something, I can't remember the exact numbers, but very highly correlated with the common factors. And of course, what people were doing in our study in the augmented group correlated with both of these things, the common factors and the ideal, you know, what we call the ideal healthcare interaction, I think, suggesting that there's some similarities in medical care to what people are doing in psychotherapy, maybe not the specifics of psychotherapy, but the general building the relationship portion of it.
Well, John, you act a little surprised by that. And I don't think we should be. These are fundamental, important interpersonal skills, which are therapeutic. And I don't think, in fact, we should expect that across different healing practices, they will be similar.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I don't think that I myself was surprised. I think I was hoping for it. And so surprised in the sense of like, wow, it worked, you know, like, great, we have evidence, you know. And I also think I was a little bit channeling the surprise that a person who is some medical people might be surprised that whatever people think of as an ideal healthcare interaction, at least experts think of it, is kind of similar to what the common factors might be like, and also from the first study, which we I think is quite robust, and makes a difference. That kind of interaction, more of that, makes for improvement for patients above and beyond whatever treatment you're giving them.
Mm-hmm. Well, this leads us to, I think we've discussed this already, but to make it explicit, that we started off the discussion with placebos, inert, either medications or procedures. You know, you can do placebo surgeries, for example.
Yes, but, amazing.
Yeah, but they're inert or hypothesized to be inert in the sense of a physiological or anatomical effect. But now we're starting to branch out and saying that medications, medical procedures, would be augmented by expectations and the relationship. So it's not placebos. And Fabrizio Benedetti, who is I don't know what you call him, but I call him the grandfather of placebo studies.
Very important.
Yeah, yeah, critically important.
Yeah.
Talked about it as placebo-like effects. So the same mechanisms are working to make various medical interventions more powerful. And so other people call them contextual effects, but you actually did a meta-analysis of the trials in medicine, actually giving treatments, and found that if the relationship was, I'll just say stronger for now, because you broke it into two dimensions. But if the relationship is stronger, the medical procedure will be more effective. So talk about that for a minute and tell us about the two components, because I think breaking it down in that way is important.
So what we did was we were interested in trying to show that in medicine, the relationship that people had with the therapeutic relationship that existed, that would have a beneficial effect. And what our meta-analysis was very different. There have been a number of other kind of meta-analyses and studies that show things that there are effects on what I would call intermediate variables. So in other words, patient satisfaction, patient's understanding of the instructions for the treatment, patients following compliance with the medication regimen, et cetera. And we were interested in a much more difficult thing, which is to show not only, well, beyond, not look at those, but look at actual outcomes, that people actually show some kind of benefit, you know, downstream, beyond just that they were more satisfied. Because it's, I think, relatively easy, and I think those are fairly strong. And that is what we did find eventually. We did find that we found randomized trials that manipulated systematically the relationship and resulted in a downstream sort of, you know, actual change in medical status, not something in intermediate. And it turned out there weren't a lot. There were only about 13 trials that we were able to discover. We're actually, interesting you ask about it, because we're working on an update to that meta-analysis, mm-hmm. which is about a decade ago, and adding all the studies we can find. It's actually fairly rare. It's hard to find these kinds of studies.
Isn't it interesting how potent the effects of expectations and the relationship are, and yet there's so few trials in medicine to show the importance of this.
I think that's right, and I wonder if I think there are maybe two reasons. One reason is that it's underappreciated, and so we have this kind of, if we appreciated more, we'd do more studies, you know, so we're kind of in this kind of weird circle. But I think the other reason is perhaps money, you know, that there's not a lot of devices and drugs, or, you know, there's a company that wants to promote that or find out if it works anyway. And so there's money to be able to pay for trials. And that's not the same. It's very difficult to get. We have a lot of trouble getting funding to run do the studies that we want to do, even more today probably these days. But
well, absolutely, and it's not that different in psychotherapy. We spend a lot of money studying the differences between treatments, randomized trials to show which treatment is more effective. But and I know personally, because I've applied for money from NIMH to study therapists and to study the common factors. It doesn't fit the medical model, John. I mean, the whole reason for placebo-controlled trials is to control for this stuff, right? This is not stuff we want to identify the effects. We want to control for it and show that the treatments work. And of course, very important, we've discovered lots of interventions that are more effective than placebos, which have been great advances in medicine. But the effects of the placebo-like effects are really important. And as you say, drug companies aren't going to support this because they can't make money Right. They make money selling drugs, not selling human interaction.
It's interesting, you know, even the name that we sometimes use for another name that we can use for placebo effects is nuisance variables. We're trying to get rid of these nuisance variables. And there's a lot, enormous efforts put into getting rid of, you know, somehow reducing the placebo effect. It's a major problem, in especially in psychiatric medications, because people do so, quote, well on, well, they do well. They do well on medicines just about as well often as they would on an antidepressant. And there's a lot of effort trying things like what I mentioned before, the placebo run-in, to try to, the purpose of it in drug trials is if people who respond during the placebo run-in are then removed in the hopes that that will somehow make there be bigger separation between drug and placebo.
Fascinating. So and of course Irving Kirsch showed that much of the antidepressant effect, or the effect of antidepressant medication, is a placebo effect.
Pretty remarkable. I mean, his research suggests it's about 80%, you know, and it's interesting because one of the things I think is really important to mention is that some people incorrectly interpret that to mean that people who take that Irving is saying people who take antidepressants don't get better. And he's not saying that. He's only saying that if you look at the randomized controlled trials, and these are, I think, pretty rigorous studies that he's been done, more than one, and other people have done them as well, but that people get better. But the problem, or I don't problem, but it's the truth is that on placebo, they also get better. Not quite as much. There is a difference. And there's a lot of debate about what the meaning of that difference is. And, you know, but, and that seems very important given that people experience a lot of side effects to medications. And if they could benefit somehow without taking, you know, without, get the same kind of benefit without the side effects, this would, of course, be a wonderful thing for people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we could spend a whole hour or more on that topic.
Could.
So, and maybe we will in one of these podcasts. But let's now think about what the implications are for psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a therapist. Mm-hmm. So how does this knowledge, which you're intimately involved in, inform you about doing psychotherapy?
I don't think it changes. I think that psychotherapists already believe that the relationship matters. I think it's a validation of that fact. I think it, in a strange way, my research, I think, is more applicable in a sense to medicine, saying what would psychologists do? Some of that, and you know, we can't have every doctor be a psychotherapist, but I think that's where there's more opportunity. The only thing I would say is that it does bolster the notion that the common factors are important. A lot of, again, most of our research is in medical conditions, but I think the same is true in anxiety and depression, that a lot of the benefits that come is not because of the specific treatment that's given, but because of the relations that's built, the expectations that come from both patient and the therapist. I think I was going to say something else. I'm trying to think what it was.
Well, John, this is interesting because I think you're right saying every therapist, even the most kind of orthodox CBT therapist, believes the relationship is important. Now, they think about it a little bit differently, probably more around, well, if the relationship is good, the patient will adhere to the protocol, and that's what's important. So we do think about it a little bit differently. But I think everybody agrees, and, you know, there's CBT people now writing books, and I contributed a chapter to it about relationship and CBT therapy. It's important. I mean, you can't do psychotherapy without a relationship. That's kind of the definition of it.
Right.
But let's talk about the expectations, because expectations occur because you have this belief that the treatment will be beneficial. So those expectations don't come just from having a warm, caring, nurturing, understanding therapist, but they also come from the explanation that therapist gives to the patient about what we're going to do in therapy. And interestingly, this goes back to Jerome Frank, who talked about this very articulately.
Yeah, I think that's right. That the explanation, I mean, so, you know, because it does beg the question, if you say, well, the common factors seem very, very important, maybe we don't need any treatment at all. We just need to build a relationship that's only common factors. We don't need it. And I don't think that's true. I think we do need something that makes sense to us and makes sense to our patients, the therapeutic regimen. Hopefully that works, right? I think the research that tries to find that there is specific benefit is important. And I think it's okay that the specific benefit might be rather small, above and beyond. I mean, that may be the case, but it isn't. But I think you are absolutely right that you need to have, to create this, the expectancies especially, you do need some kind of, the patient has to believe in you to some degree and believe in this.
Well, believe in you, but also believe in the treatment.
Yes, in the therapy.
You're giving.
Right. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. That you are competent in delivering something that they think will help them, that you think also will help them. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that is very important. I think, by the way, again, to take it back briefly to medicine, I think it's exactly the same in medicine, that part of the benefit of a treatment and getting people to take it in terms of compliance, you know, is the explanation. This is what it is. Here are the side effects. Here's how we can manage them. Here's how it works. Here's why it works. All and tailored, of course, to the person you're speaking with. You're going to give a very different explanation to a biochemist than somebody who doesn't have a high school degree, you know, in terms of respectfully at each level, but speaking their language, making sure they understand.
And very important in psychotherapy is the way that we do it, the language we use, kind of taking into account the cultural beliefs about various disorders, kind of the folk psychology, is really important. Well, Leah Crum says, and she's talking about medicine, but the same is true in psychotherapy. You want your doctor to get it, to understand the disorder and its treatment, and to get me to understand me as a person with this disorder. And those two dimensions are really important.
I agree with you, you know, and as those are sometimes referred to as kind of maybe warmth and competence, you know, and I do think it's interesting that there's to some degree a belief that those things might not go together that well, that someone who's super confident, you know, the sort of maybe unfair caricature of the super surgeon, you know, the expert surgeon is an arrogant sort of jerk, but he's really good at, or she is really good at doing surgery. And that's kind of considered to be okay, which I think is a big mistake. And I think it is not true that people can't be both warm and competent. Mm-hmm. And I think patients want that. But I think that we overvalue in medicine, perhaps, and maybe even in psychotherapy to the degree we focus too much on technique and not enough on, can I give just a brief, funny, negative story about me?
Yeah.
But in my training, one of my supervisors, I was eager to impress my supervisor with the formulation that I had about the case and, you know, the plan and whatever. And at some point, he asked me, "Oh, what color did the person was the guy's eyes that you were talking with?" You know, and he didn't really care about what color his eyes was, but I think he was pushing me back toward who is this unique individual right in front of you, and me as a trainee, and especially a trainee, you know, early in my career, very focused on the technical. I'm trying to do it, quote, do it right. I'm trying to get that part of it, and I'm not maybe getting the patient because I'm focusing on, you know, the parts of the patient that I'm trying to treat, which is a, you know, big problem.
Yeah. Well, John, you know, in my supervision of therapists, both in training and practicing therapists, there's two kind of extremes that I think are not optimal. One is somebody who's very focused on the protocol and wants to follow that over and above anything else. I mean, the templated notes in the VA are an example of institutionalizing a bad practice, because the focus then is on the treatment and not on the patient. But on the other side, we have therapists who are warm, caring, and empathic, but there's no coherent plan for how we're going to overcome difficulties. And we really need, as you say, to be in the middle. It's not exactly the middle. It's emphasizing both of those things. And they're compatible. They really go together. How I explain the treatment we're going to do or what we're going to do in therapy, I have to do that in an empathic and understanding way.
So, absolutely. Yeah. And to the degree it's not delivered in an empathic way, and you create some sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say a negative relationship, but maybe a less trusting relationship, the patient may not disclose things that are extremely important. This is true in psychotherapy, of course, where that's a big part of the whole thing, talking about things that are very difficult to talk about. But obviously, the very same thing in medicine, where if you have a kind of neutral, cold relationship or not, you know, it's harder to talk about something that might be disturbing you, that might feel uncomfortable, you know, something sexual or mental health issues or whatever it would be, if you don't have that feeling of trust with it. And I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, each pole has a danger.
Yeah. Well, John, we're running out of time. I know I could go on for another hour. This fascinating topic. We're going to think about different issues of the podcast to explore some of these issues. But it's been wonderful to talk to you and to see you again. I think this is fascinating work. And again, I encourage the listeners to read the placebo research. There's fascinating nuggets in there that really inform us about how to do psychotherapy.
Yeah, and I'll just echo that. I agree with you completely. Thank you so much for inviting me about the placebo research, that it's really not about the placebo. It's about lots of other things. It's about medicine broadly. It's about psychotherapy. It's about things outside of medicine or psychotherapy. You know, our expectancy, you know, Ali Akram is very interested in applying mindsets and things that come from this literature to a much broader array of things, how we live our lives. So I think it has really interesting implications. It's like you said about talking about it. I too could go on and on, and I often say that. So you don't want to get me started at a party talking about placebo effects 4 hours later.
So, well, this is great, John. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Take care.
Okay, that concludes this very special episode of the Making Therapy Better podcast with Bruce Wampold. We hope you'll stay tuned for the rest of season 3. We have a lot of exciting guests coming up and can't wait to share that with you every other Wednesday morning on wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, today's podcast was brought to you by CarePaths EHR. Are you a clinical supervisor or do you run a training clinic? CarePaths is a comprehensive electronic health record system built with you in mind. Research shows that therapists get better outcomes and improve more over the course of their careers when they regularly measure their clients' treatment progress and experiences in therapy and then discuss those measures collaboratively. Along with a host of other features, CarePaths makes it easy for therapists to integrate measurement-based care into their practice with just a few clicks. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about our EHR system designed with training clinics in mind, and join us on the path toward making therapy better. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. We hope to see you next time.